It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The Madison Early Music Festival is this weekend. So what is early music, you ask? Well, you're listening to it right now. And our two guests today are going to tell us, and one of them is going to play for us. Cheryl Benzman-Rowe is the co-artistic director of the Madison Early Music Festival and a Grammy Award-winning vocalist. She's also a former member of the Waverly Consort Early Music Ensemble. Lisa Terry is a cellist and gambist. That's someone who plays the viola da gamba with the Tempesta di Mare Philadelphia Baroque Orchestra. She's also a member of the Parthenia Viol Consort. Most importantly, Lisa is sitting in our studios with her viola da gamba. We're going to ask about what that is exactly. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's get this out of the way, Lisa. Our listeners can't see it, but there is an instrument in the room. It looks a lot like a cello, but cellos only have four strings. This has six strings from what I'm seeing. Tell us what a viola da gamba is.
The viola da gamba is a family of instruments invented in Italy at the end of the 15th century. They are descended from the lute family. There was a Spanish lute that looked a whole lot like this, a little smaller, but it had a flat back instead of that rounded back, you know, that most of the Renaissance lutes have.
Right.
So the Spanish lute had a flat back. It had six strings and seven frets. And they decided it might be fun to curve the bridge and start playing tunes on it with a bow. And that's exactly what the viola da gamba is. It's viol of the leg is what it literally means.
Oh, interesting. So you also play the cello.
I do.
What is the difference in terms of sound between the viola da gamba and the cello?
They play in the same range. The bass.
They're both bass clef.
I'm holding a bass viola da gamba. It comes in all sizes like Renaissance instruments did. Mm. You know, it replicates the human voice. So there's soprano, alto, tenor, bass sizes, just like violin, viola, cello, double bass. So but the bass viola da gamba that I'm holding, which is cello sized, plays in the same range, bass clef, alto clef, tenor clef, whatever. But kind of the range of the bass and baritone and tenor voice, human voice.
So give us a snippet of what this sounds like
here. Okay.
So you just went through the range of all the strings there. You play cello. What made you decide to take this instrument up?
I heard Bach's Es ist vollbracht when I was 18 years old in college. We did the St. John Passion at my college, and my music history professor was playing the viola da gamba solo in this beautiful alto aria. And when I heard that piece, it was a sound I'd never heard before, but I knew I had to play the instrument.
So does it bring out something like richer than you can get in a four stringed instrument?
Nope. It's just the music that this instrument plays and the sound that it makes with the gut strings. I had never heard strings made of the more ancient natural materials of sheep intestines.
That's interesting.
You know, I was just a cellist playing on steel strings as a kid. And when I heard this instrument, and then I could hear that it could play chords.
Oh, cool. Right.
Like that. And then I heard the type of music that it could accompany with voices. It reminded me of the folk music and the bluegrass music that I love so much. I grew up in Mississippi.
So it crosses over. Cheryl, we've got this early music festival coming up. What drew you to early music, and why are you running this festival?
Well, what drew me to early music in the beginning was really started in high school when I was in a madrigal group.
Oh, cool.
So our choir had a select group of singers from the bigger group, the bigger ensemble, and we were singing English madrigals from the Elizabethan time and Italian madrigals, you know, fa la 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 la, and I'm sure a lot of people who, even up to this day, who sing in choir do a lot of these madrigals. Mm-hmm. Now is the month of Maying. So that's how I became interested in early music. And
So madrigals, my kids are into choir, and the mm-hmm. madrigals, what I love about them, in addition to the music, is the dress. That, you know, they dress up in like Baroque Renaissance costumes.
Right. And have madrigal dinners. I know at Middleton High School.
Right.
No, I don't know if they're still doing it, but they used to have a big madrigal dinner that the theater department and the choir were involved
with food
in.
That people
with
might have eaten hundreds,
a big
hundreds
feast,
of years ago. This is fascinating.
Turkey drumsticks.
I love this. Do you love this? Do you like Baroque music? Are you heading to the Early Music Festival this weekend? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also email us, as usual, at ideas@wpr.org. And I'm going to start giving out prizes for people who tweet us. We want to get more tweets. WPR Mornings is our Twitter handle. The Early Music Festival is taking place here in Madison through July 14th. I said Baroque music, but it's not just limited to Baroque music. How do you define early music?
Well, it's a broad time period, starting from the medieval era, Renaissance music to Baroque music. I always think of it being music before 1800 as a general idea. The earliest music from the medieval times, there are pieces that were not written down until very late, mm-hmm. but the music we're doing this weekend, actually, a lot of things changed during that time period because print of all kinds were more available to the general public. And that was part of the Reformation, too, you know, bringing the music to the people, bringing literature to the people, not just the richer class or the high up clergy.
Lisa, are we only talking European and Western music when we're talking about early music here?
Kind of largely, yeah. It's Western music is when we say early music. I think we're talking about Western music.
And how much of this was religious music?
A good portion, but tons is secular also. I don't know if it's half and half, but there's plenty of both.
And a lot of people did music at home. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no TV or radio.
Right. Or internet.
Right, exactly. Right. But also the church was a huge patron of the arts, music and visual arts, painting, sculpture.
Greensleeves, to me, it comes to mind. Is that from this era?
That's a Renaissance piece.
Yeah. That's kind of an early Renaissance piece that has lasted a long time.
And a lot of guitar players find their classical guitar players, that's like their first piece that they learn.
Yeah, well, it was a hit then, and it still is.
From Elizabethan England.
Right. So are there any other things that our ears might recognize in early music, Lisa?
That our ears might recognize. There's probably a lot of tunes that are famous that continue today. A lot of Bach tunes, like Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, something like that. But
we are talking about early music, and we are Lisa Terry is in with her viola da gamba. And she's going to play it this morning. This festival, it's already in swing, or it's going to be starting in a couple of days?
We're in the middle of it.
Okay.
We started last Saturday, mm-hmm. and Lisa played on the concert with the group Quicksilver. And this weekend, we have several events coming up. We have a dance with a live Renaissance band with dance instruction at Great Hall. That is tonight, 7:30, at Memorial Union.
That's a lot of fun.
And then two concerts, Scola Antiqua from Chicago on Friday night at Mills Hall.
Okay.
And Saturday is our big all-festival production with all our students and faculty.
We are going to listen to Terry play this instrument that she is sitting here in our studio with in a moment. It's The Morning Show.
Thank you.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are previewing, as you can hear, this weekend's Early Music Festival in Madison. Cheryl Benzman-Rowe is the co-director of the fest, and Lisa Terry is a cellist and gambist who is performing in the fest. She's also going to perform with her viola da gamba right now in our studios. Lisa, tell me about what you're going to play.
Well, I thought I'd play one of the very earliest printed pieces that we have for the viola da gamba. It comes from a publication from about 1550 in Italy, but I think the piece dates back to the 15th century, which is when the viola da gamba was invented. And it's a beautiful piece called La Spagna by Diego Ortiz.
I'd love to hear it. Is nothing better than watching a good musician play her instrument. Thank you very much. That was beautiful. It was wonderful to watch. It was wonderful to hear. That was Lisa Terry playing the viola da gamba. And also, our executive producer, Keely Butino, was taping this. Are we doing this on Facebook Live? So check out our Ideas Network Facebook page to see Terry play this. Do you play a period instrument like the lute or perhaps a harpsichord or a viola da gamba? What made you want to learn this instrument? And how do you explain to people what it is? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. This festival, Cheryl, which is ongoing and is going to be ending this weekend, you said that you're going to be having people perform from Chicago and from other places. Mm-hmm. Where are people coming from to see this?
A lot of people are coming from the Madison community. We have people coming from Milwaukee, Chicago, and some people do spend the weekend in Madison with a tie into the art fair that's coming up.
Okay,
and
right.
So they'll come to some of our concerts. But our workshop participants come from all over, as far as California, Minnesota, New York, all over the country, and our performing artists as well.
So one of the things that Lisa said that intrigued me is that the piece that she just played was written down in the 16th century, but it likely came from the 15th century. Who remembered it to write it down?
It was the tune.
This is Lisa talking.
Yeah, this
about
is
it.
Lisa. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the tune La Spagna is an ancient tune, and the composer Ortiz took the tune and did this fantasia, sort of a newly composed piece based on it. So that's what it is. And he wrote, I think, six recitatas, they're called. That's the word for fantasia fantasia in English, recitata in Italian or Spanish. He wrote six of them on La Spagna. So I could play all six for you.
Yeah. That would be interesting to me. But how does this, I'm kind of trying to get at what we're hearing in terms of the richness of the sound here, in terms of this particular piece of music. What am I hearing that I'm not going to hear just on a regular cello or even an alto violin type instrument?
Yeah. Well, the viola da gamba family is a completely different family from the violin family. Different origins. The violin family came from a arm-held medieval fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it developed into this incredible piece of genius that is the violin. You know, that when they figured that out, those proportions and everything,
right,
that was amazing achievement. But also at the end of the 15th century, the viola da gamba family came from a plucked instrument, a lute, that then was bowed. So the flat back of the viola da gamba family, which also comes in all sizes, as I said, compared to the carved back of the violin, creates a completely different sound
mm-hmm.
world. So, and then the six strings spread across a bridge that vibrates the top creates sort of a different set of harmonics
mm-hmm.
that you hear. So those two things, flat back, more strings, different way that the big body vibrates. And yeah, it just creates a different signature that's kind of gets you in a different way.
We were talking to Lisa Terry, who you just heard, who has a viola da gamba in her, I'm not sure, lap, between her legs, in her arms. She is holding this instrument. This instrument is holding her. We're also talking to Cheryl Benjamin Rowe, who is the co-artistic director of the Early Music Festival, which is here in Madison this week. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. And we have Liz in Kenosha. Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say thank you for being a champion of music, and especially early music. I'm a violist as well, and I got extremely interested in listening to your show this morning when you started talking about your Saturday performance, which will include students. I'd like to know very much what type of teaching you do at the festival.
Well, throughout the week, and we start our classes on Sunday, we have classes every day until Saturday when we have the final performance. We have classes that run from 9 to 5.
Mm.
Everything from different techniques for recorder, violin, gamba, voice. And at the end of the day, from 3:15 to 5, we all come together and have a community experience working on a concert together. So the faculty play side by side with the students.
And I am assuming that some of these are master classes?
We don't do too many master classes. It's really hands-on involvement. There are some.
Yeah.
But we also do a lot of chamber music, which is for earlier, you know, we're not doing Beethoven and Brahms.
Right,
we're doing...
Right. So kids who are in middle school, who are in high school, who are playing in the orchestra, who are, as we affectionately call ourselves, orc dorks, they can come and take
classes.
Well,
it's actually
here.
For adults.
Okay.
This is summer music camp for adults.
That's pretty awesome,
yeah.
Too.
So 18, actually, this year, our youngest student is 18, and our oldest is 94.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the defining characteristics of early music and how it started out perhaps as church music and then kind of runs into the Renaissance. How did the Renaissance change this, Cheryl?
Oh, that's a good question.
Okay, I'll sit down now.
Right. Well, first of all, there were a lot of champions of the arts, like the Medici family, who were huge patrons of the arts in Italy. So everybody needs a patron. So they would commission great works of music, masses, motets, and what other kinds of things? I mean,
yeah.
And visual arts,
right?
Also,
yeah. And then things like the Habsburgs, who ran the Holy Roman Empire,
mm-hmm.
they would compete with other countries for musicians and artists. They would steal, like bribe, bring away, because that was a sign of their wealth and their importance and their sophistication to have the best artists of all kinds in their employ. And they would rob from each other, you know. And it was pretty cool to think that we were so, as artists, were so elevated and desired. In
Sounds
days.
Like sports leagues.
You know, really it is. And in this country, well, we do have great patrons.
Yes.
At our beautiful Overture Center.
Right.
But they were supporting artists more than anything that's happening in this country today, that's for sure.
So money fuels this kind of thing. That is really what made the difference for this kind of music, is that people with money started thinking that this made their status higher to have this kind of music.
And reflected their education and sensibility. But even the Thomas Morley in Elizabethan England wrote a treatise. Would you call it a treatise? The practical, what's the title of that? I can't remember off the top of my head, but he had a whole list. He's a composer, Thomas Morley, mm-hmm. who wrote, now is the month of May, that to be an educated person, one should know how to dance, know how to read music, know how to play an instrument. And so a guide to being a well-rounded person. And this was very respected by society, to have these skills.
This is the precursor to the idea of the Renaissance man, or the Renaissance person, as I like to say.
Right.
We are talking about early music because there is an early music festival that is going on in Madison through Saturday. Cheryl Benz-Monroe is the co-artistic director of that festival. Lisa Terry is playing in the festival. She's also playing here in our studios. We heard something a few minutes ago. We're going to hear something in a few minutes more. I want to, you know, when we think of classical music, Lisa, we think of Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, all those guys. What are the differences really between the pre-1800s music and the music that started coming out in the Romantic period when they started composing?
Well, you know, some of the earliest music we have maybe sketches of, some melodies, maybe some two or three part writing. That's the medieval era.
Mm-hmm.
But by the
two or three part writing,
yeah,
I don't want to get too much
duets,
into the weeds here, but
duets or trios, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you
okay.
might have that. Yeah, by the Renaissance period, you started having written down music, first written by hand, but then after the development of the printing press, so you'd have printed music,
mm-hmm.
but of a different kind. That was each individual line was important. And the rules of writing were what's called polyphony, in that the if you say you have four singers singing at once or four instruments playing, they have to intermingle by certain rules, so that they only play certain notes at a certain time and in a certain way. But they thought of the music as a single line. The soprano line was important, the alto line important, tenor, bass, like that. But by around 1600, things started changing, and they started thinking of music as a melody and a bass with the idea of chords that functions. Are you familiar
mm-hmm.
yeah, with that?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole different way of looking at it. In the Renaissance, they thought of music as kind of horizontal, and in the Baroque, they thought of it as vertical. And so they started thinking more of bar lines and controlling the music that way. So it was a big change around 1600, different dates in different countries. But the birth of opera in the very early 17th century is kind of a real demarcation of the Baroque period.
And interesting. And this was when the printing press was being invented. So
earlier. That's in the Renaissance is when the printing press was invented. Yeah, that's in... But, and then things just kept changing. Tastes really changed more than ways of composing, so that the taste of the period, of each subsequent period, drove what kinds of music you hear.
There are different modes between the earlier music and the Romantic period.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about that a little bit.
Well, the modes kind of tie in with this idea of Renaissance polyphonic writing.
Mm-hmm.
Modes are what rule the way you can, what notes you can use, what notes go together, what
mm-hmm.
notes sound well, modes and intervals and things like that. The idea of chord progressions is a new thought that defines the Baroque period. And then that continues on into the classical and romantic.
So I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. Can mm-hmm. you play something that is maybe a mode from early music and then something that is a current modes that we use?
Sure. I mean, the first piece I played was modal because
okay.
it just was...
Mm-hmm.
But if I were playing that in a later style, I might make it more harmonic in function. With a lot of this sort
of
signifying a cadence. You don't get that as much in earlier music.
Interesting. I love the velocity. That's the only word I can say of that instrument. It's just it fills the room. Cheryl Benz-Monroe, when did this music start to decline and be forgotten, and how did we bring it back?
Well, first of all, it developed as concert halls started to get bigger, instruments started to be, for instance, using steel strings instead of gut strings, so they were louder. These instruments, earlier instruments, are mostly wood, and so a flute would be made out of wood, not made out of metal.
Ooh, interesting.
And as things developed, concert halls got bigger, and they needed instruments to play louder. And even the way opera, early opera, was sung compared to how it's sung now, you didn't have to worry about projection as much because all these instruments were played in smaller spaces. One person who was pretty instrumental in reviving early music was actually Mendelssohn. Hmm. He rediscovered Bach.
Oh, so interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen some things where Brahms had found some Monteverdi madrigals that he...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that he wrote accompaniments to. So composers of the Romantic era were definitely looking back at early music to look at the compositional structure and, I mean, they're beautiful works of art.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the big early music revival happened in the late 50s, early 60s. There was a group in New York.
In the 20th century.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The New York Pro Musica, groups in England, just rediscovering all these wonderful treasures. And now there are many, many groups that are performing this music.
We are talking about the Early Music Festival that is happening now through this weekend. We're taking your calls. What do you think of this music? Have you played an older instrument and you love the way it hears, the way it plays to your ears? Would you like to go to this and maybe bring your kids? Can you bring your kids to,
yes,
to these? Okay.
Yes.
800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, today we have Pro Tools, we have synthesizers that can sound like just about anything, just about. Back then they had lutes and viola da gambas and harpsichords. What other instruments were common during this era, Lisa, that we wouldn't recognize today?
Well, we all know recorders, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, every parent of a third grader knows what a recorder is.
But I think you would be amazed to see a Pifferow performance, say, and all the amazing sizes of recorders that mm-hmm. they play. So it's just astonishing, from things that are way taller than a person to little bitty ones. And that was the Renaissance ideal, is to have families of instruments and then have every imaginable size. So you have huge range of sizes of violin family. They used to have, I think, 5 or 6 sizes of viola.
Mm.
So just to cover every possible range, little niche in the polyphonic music. And then there's other wind instruments that are really cool, like the cornetto. Do you know what that is?
No.
That's a wooden instrument. It's curved, but it has a brass-type mouthpiece. It's not made of brass, but it makes it sound like a trumpet, but like a trumpet you have never heard. It's like a human voice combined with the most beautiful trumpety sound. It's just incredible, especially when Carrie plays.
Yes. Yeah.
Cornetto.
Cornetto, right.
Okay.
And then there are the shams.
Right.
The predecessor to the oboe, but also in all different sizes, from alto to
contrabass.
Huge. The crumb horn.
Wow. Which, I love these names.
Right. The crumb horn. In a way, it reminds me of a kazoo because it has a reed, but the reed is covered and it makes a very buzzy sound.
There's all kinds of plucked instruments instead of just lute. There's lute, guitar, bandura, cittern.
Theorbo.
Theorbo, right. Arch lute. There's so many beautiful instruments of different sizes, and they all fill a need in the composer's mind. And so they were invented.
And don't forget the sackbut.
Oh my God, please don't forget sackbut.
Sackbut, the predecessor to the trombone.
We're doing a show here on classical music, on early music. Sackbut is not a word that I thought I would be hearing. So we're pretty highbrow here at the morning show. Talk to me about what a sackbut is.
It's the predecessor to the trombone, and it also comes in a family of sizes, including this huge contrabass trombone where you have to have a handle on the slide to get it all the way out for the lowest notes. And actually this group Pifaro, the Renaissance band, had someone playing this instrument on Sunday, and the sound is just very resonant. but if people do come to the concert on Saturday night, they will see a lot of these instruments played. More sackbuts and cornetti
Okay.
No one has ever seen that many on
stage.
I'm just to
see these instruments.
Yeah, we have voices and organ, and then all the families of instruments are represented.
We are talking about the Early Music Festival, which is running now through Saturday, as you just heard. We're going to be back to talk about more. Here's some more music and take your calls, 800-642-1234, in a moment. Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are listening to early music this morning, previewing the Early Music Festival, which is ending. It's going on now, and it's going to be ending on Saturday in Madison. Cheryl Bensman-Rowe is a co-director of the fest, and Lisa Terry is a cellist and gambist who is performing at the fest and performing here in our studios. We're also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And I'm just going to add here that as you guys were talking about the instruments that we have not heard that are sort of out of favor, I'm going to try and find clips to those instruments to put on WPR.org. Right now, Dina from Hazel Green, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. This is a great program. I was in Florence, Italy in the mid-1980s in the Piazza Vecchio on a Wednesday night. It's open late. And heard this beautiful, haunting, enchanting music coming into the art galleries and walked down the piazza. And there was a group playing early instruments. And it was the first time I'd seen a wooden recorder. And the music just was so beautiful and so astoundingly different from what I'd heard played in symphony halls. So I had a couple of questions. The first is, do you have any recommendations on how to find recordings of early music? And the second is, does a hurdy-gurdy fit into this somehow, into an early music instrument, or is that come later? So
okay,
those are my two questions.
Dina, thank you for that. I'm going to take your questions backwards. I want to talk about the hurdy-gurdy first, and then we'll figure out where she can get this music.
The hurdy-gurdy is used more in medieval music. I was in an early drama with the Waverly Consort, and we used a hurdy-gurdy to create this very spooky atmosphere with Sybil, the soothsayer. So it is used more for medieval music. Actually, there was something I saw on Facebook where someone made one with a 3D printer now. So, you know.
Oh, wow.
But it creates a drone sound.
Hmm. And it looks sort of like, I'm looking at a picture, it's shaped sort of like a lute. I mean, it has a body, a round mm-hmm. body like that.
That's its resonating chamber, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's there's something on top of it? I'm not sure that I understand. Can you tell me how it works, Lisa?
I think it, I'm not exactly sure. We can look it up. But okay. I think it has strings in it and then a wheel that's coated with rosin, and you turn that wheel with a crank.
Oh, yes,
and
there it is.
Rubs on the strings and creates the drums.
Ah, she just described the picture I'm looking at that I did not see. So we are talking about the Early Music Festival. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. In a moment, we're going to ask Lisa Terry to play, but we're going to go to Neil first. Neil from Slinger, welcome to the program.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is the omission of the tempered tuning, which diffused from China, happening in these periods. Also, the tuning bass, and I was a maker of Baroque and Renaissance lutes in the late 50s, 60s, and some into the 70s when the revival started. And there was a dearth of information from Europe and original instruments in the U.S. and even in Europe. So much of the stuff that's being replicated, I think, today is probably better than what was done, what we did in the 60s, late 50s, 60s, 70s, early 70s.
Wow, Neil, thank you for that. When you said the word better, both of our guests nodded their heads enthusiastically. Lisa, talk to me about how we've learned how to make these instruments better, considering that they were made hundreds of years ago.
Well, one thing is the people who are interested in making them have had a few years to work with players and see what works and what doesn't. And they've gotten really, really interested in whatever instruments we can find that are still around from the old days, but also in paintings and drawings of instruments. And they've started really believing what they see. They look at the drawings and they try to make the instruments exactly like that, instead of just thinking, oh, that's some artist's rendition of it. No, those are actually what they looked like. So the technology of our bows, of the bows that violinists and gambists use, is amazing how much it's changed. Mm. What's available now that are real historical type bows that make us sound different and play differently from what we used back in the 70s.
Very interesting.
And then wind instruments and everything is changing. Much, much better quality, better materials, and authentic methods of making it. They try to make them the way they were made using those materials and techniques.
So music history and musicianship go together in
mm-hmm.
this.
Definitely.
So I'm assuming that instrument that you are holding right now, you didn't just go down to the corner store and buy. I'm assuming
true.
That there may be like one or maybe two places in the world that make it.
No, there's probably 50 or
oh,
more. Yeah,
okay,
there's
good.
A lot of makers.
Nice,
yeah.
Nice to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, maybe more. I don't really know. I've never counted.
So are these generally artisans like Neil who are making them by hand?
That's correct.
Taking a year or more to make one? Talk to me about that.
That's absolutely true. It does take a while to make them, and they're made by hand in small shops and just carefully done according to the maker's research. They get an idea of what instrument they're copying or what variations they're going to do on a historical instrument. They can go any direction they want to, but they use some guidelines of what has worked 400 years ago.
And so you shop around? Do you call and say, this is what I want? What are you doing? How does this work?
By going to these early music festivals like Madison and Berkeley and Boston and in Europe, you get to meet makers who come there to display their wares. You also meet your teacher's instruments. Say if you're a student and you're looking for one to buy, you see what your teacher has or other players have. There's plenty of information online about the makers. They all have websites.
Right.
You can Google that very easily and look at the pictures and try to find out who is using their instruments.
And most of them are here in the U.S., in Western Europe?
I would
Europe?
Say most in Europe, a lot in Japan. There are a lot of makers in China now, and quite a few in America and in Canada.
Great. So you are holding this instrument, and we are waiting for you to play something else. What are you going to play for us next?
All right. I'm going to play a lively tune from early 17th century England, when the viola da gamba was a very popular solo instrument, as was the lute. And different composers vied for attention. They would have little battles with each other as to which one was better, the lute or the viola da gamba. So I'm going to play.
Awesome.
This is written in a lot of little chords and hopping around the instrument, much like you would play plucked on a lute. I'm going to play it with a bow. And it's called Messieurs Allemands, which is a little dance in four beats to the bar.
You got it. Was fascinating. That sounded like that felt like more like a march, and you were moving as you were playing this. Talk to me about how you're integrated with the instrument and the movements.
Well, this is a dance,
and so you were dancing.
And one tends to play dances with the sort of rhythm and feel that someone could dance to, especially in this era. In the early 17th century, most dances that you see published were probably dances people danced to. So, yeah. So
we had a caller, Dina, who asked two questions, and we only answered one. And the other question was, where do we find this kind of music?
One way to get started would be if they come to our website, www.madisonearlymusic.org. And there are links for all the groups that perform on the series, and so you can find out about their recordings on their websites. I think knowing the names of the groups can really help. Sometimes you can order their recordings right off their websites. Mm-hmm. There is the other name I don't want to say. Well, okay. On Amazon, if you were to do a search for early music, I hate to say it, but but I think just seeing...
But the money goes, if they buy it through your website or their own websites, the money goes more directly to them than it does through a middleman.
Yeah, I think it's good to go through the artist's website.
Okay.
And just seeing who is performing in Milwaukee. There's a wonderful series, Early Music Now. And they have a great season. And just to see the names of the groups and follow through that way, looking on their websites.
I should note that if it's on Amazon, that does show that there's a market for this, yes?
Right. Yes.
That kind of keeps it alive. Perhaps. Perhaps. That's a whole other... The music industry in general, that's a whole other issue. We talked earlier, Cheryl, about... the fact that a lot of this music wasn't written down, but then it became written down, and some of these were folk music that sort of like passed through generations. Is there any sense of what we might be missing, what may have been lost?
Oh, I'm sure a lot of music has been lost.
How about music by women? That's not indicated at all.
Like Mozart's sister.
Well, or even earlier, probably all that music that's called anonymous that we see. That could very well have been by women composers.
And there is one woman, Hildegard von Bingen, who her music was carried on all kinds of chant, beautiful, beautiful medieval chant that we still have.
Oh, yeah.
So you talked earlier, Lisa, about things. As things evolved, we started thinking about things in measures and in bars. How did the notation that we know now, the sheet music, how was that invented?
With the invention of the printing press, I guess. Mm-hmm. Before that, music didn't look that different, but it was written by hand on copper plates and then printed. So the scribes had to write it all backwards on the copper plates.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So the composer would write a chart on a piece of parchment. The expert who was the engraver would write it backwards on copper so then it could print forwards.
So, Cheryl, let's say that I have a child who plays the viola or plays the cello and or maybe even plays the recorder and wants to get into early music. How would they be able to do that in this day and age? Here in Madison, Wisconsin, or maybe in Chicago, or maybe in La Crosse. How do we get into that?
Well, there are communities that do offer lessons in recorder and viola da gamba. In fact, there's somebody in Madison right now, Eric Miller, who has started a gamba consort for kids in high school and younger. And I think just looking to see what different community music offers. And also, it's good to always ask your music educator at your school, the orchestra director or band director. They may know of people, choir directors.
And go online so that you can hear what this music sounds like.
Yes.
And go to the music festival, which is running through Saturday.
Saturday.
Cheryl Bensman-Rowe is the co-artistic director of the Madison Early Music Festival and a Grammy Award-winning vocalist. She's also a former member of the Waverly Consort Early Music Ensemble. Lisa Terry is a cellist and gambist. That's someone who plays the viola da gamba with a Tempesta di Mari Philadelphia Baroque Orchestra. She's also a member of the Parthenia Viol Consort, and she played for us this morning. Cheryl and Lisa, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brian Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.